All right, so I got Kelda Miller. We're moving into chapter two of Sepp Holzer's book, but first, Kelda has a joke.
Okay. So what does the hippie say when the drugs wear off?
I give up. What does the hippie say?
His music sucks.
Okay.
You don't think it's funny. I actually had that happen once at a fish show. So I was like, wait a minute, no one's dancing because this music kind of sucks right now. Oh.
Oh no.
Yeah.
See, I guess I don't get it because I've never done any drugs. So maybe if I had done some, then I would understand it better.
Or have you ever tried to go dancing and the music doesn't actually work for dancing? You ever go dancing, Paul?
Yeah. I don't look like enough of a freak show being a giant. I want to go and dance, too. Hey, everybody, look at me. I'm not just giant, but I'm giant and wiggling.
Let's get you dancing. I'll try to think of a good time. That'll be fun.
I know that at the PDC that I took, they required dancing. That was like, you know, because they had that talent show thing on the very last night, and I didn't care for it. It was contra dancing.
Uh-huh.
And then later, I went contra dancing, and not only did I get crazy tired really fast, but on top of that, I kept bumping into people. And if I bump into somebody, it's not like... Like, I imagine with regular people, when you bump into somebody, it's like, oh, sorry, and that's like the end of it. But when I bump into somebody, they usually hit the floor. And so, you know, you feel horrible just, you know, knocking people to the ground, even if it is an accident. So it was very much a not fun thing. And they had this weird thing where it was like... when you go, if somebody asks you to dance, you are not allowed to say no. And so after one dance, I was trying to get some water, and I was thinking, I gotta go sit down and rest. And a woman asked me to go dance, and I could barely stand, and I was just tired, and I bet she really regretted that. So then, after that dance, I went and I hid. So that way, once the dance got started, then, you know, it's like, okay, I got out of that one.
Yeah.
And then I think I found the exit and got the hell out of there. So anyway, yeah, do I dance? No, I'm not into it.
Right.
Sorry.
Okay.
part of, I bet you there are guys my size that do, and I'm just not one of them. All right, so I was going to do a joke, but maybe we'll save it for the next podcast.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're on a chapter two of Sepp Holzer's book, and this chapter is called Alternative Agriculture. And I started marking up so much of the chapter that I started to feel really guilty, like the publishers are going to send Guido and Vito out to talk to me about how that's not okay. So I stopped marking the chapter. And I mean, this is a chapter that's so rich with information that... I guess if people like this, like these, because we just marked off a few pages so far. This podcast only goes up, it's pages 53 through 64.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just going to have to go buy the book.
Oh, yeah, sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. So, and I was thinking to myself for the first section, which is called Basic Ideas, I kept seeing a lot of stuff where it's like, oh, that's going to be like a huge portion of the podcast is Kelda talking about that. And so I thought, I'll mark up the other stuff. But, okay, so on page 53, do you have anything marked up?
Well, I've kind of done it differently, but, I mean, just interesting, of course, he's talking about subsidies to agriculture and how they're not really helping, and so that's... Well, it's interesting they do that in Austria as well as here. Our farm subsidies actually... just hurt the situation. What is it? I was doing books for a farmer once, and then there's this whole category on like QuickBooks for putting in how much money you get from the government if you're a farm. And of course, she's a small organic farmer, so she didn't get that. But it was just like, wow.
Yeah, my understanding is that for most subsidies, things that it's like more than half their income.
Wow. Yeah.
Now I when I was like 19, because when I was 17, I mean as a kid I worked on farms, but when I was 17 I worked on this one farm, and then eventually I ended up working in their office doing software development because you know they were such a big farm that you know they had to document all kinds of stuff in order to be able to get all their subsidies.
right, totally, yeah.
Yeah, and so then you know they optimized all of their paperwork and stuff like that. In fact, there was one guy there who everybody called Briefcase because he was like the guy that was the main number cruncher, and he hated being called Briefcase, which in this particular culture made it so that no one actually knows your real name. So it's a nasty culture. I'm not really proud of, I guess. It's true. And then the other thing is I think is important is that once you start traveling subsidy road, then and you get into the commodity foods kind of a thing, then you go out and you raise your crop and then you take it to the central collection unit, and you don't know how much you're going to get for it until you get there, and then on top of that they don't give a shit about the quality. You know, it's like, does it look like corn? There are certain quality factors, but it's like not the qualities you would hope that they would have. So if it's caked in chemicals, that's fine. If it tastes like shit, that's fine. Stuff like that. And so then they just, yeah, it's, whereas the quality is, I believe, the most, one of the most important things that's being effectively bred out. It's, I mean, because pretty much what they want is the pounds. How many pounds do you bring? That's the thing that determines how much you get paid.
Right. Well, and then the farmers are tied into this whole system. He talks about it where it's like once you get the big equipment for the specialized crop and all the investments going into that and all the, it's just hard to change with the, if there's not local food being grown, people just don't switch maybe just to growing local food because they've already got all this equipment for tilling and processing and doing all this other stuff that's shipped away somewhere else.
Right. So the part that I marked from this section is towards the end, and I got this part marked. What your neighbors are doing is not necessarily right for you. Quite the contrary. What everyone around you is currently growing or breeding is already available in abundance and is, therefore, no longer interesting as a product. So this is something I know I've heard him say many times in person. I don't know if it comes up in his videos or not. But basically, he changes his primary income crop, if you will, all the damn time. And a lot of times, it's not just the growies, but also the animals.
Yeah.
So he'll grow, because the idea is that it's like if nobody's raising yaks in his area, and he raises yaks, then he can sell the meat for probably triple the price of what they're currently selling beef or pork. So this is part of where he explores this market, and so then he starts building up this clientele of people that are willing to pay triple price or even higher, and then the more interesting the stuff that he offers, the more they're willing to pay.
Well,
so
yeah.
Why bother with the stuff that's like what everybody else has?
Yeah, I mean it sounds like it kind of sucks for him because he'll get an idea and then he'll do it really well, and then other people start catching on and doing it too. So he's leading the curve, he's ahead of the market in a lot of ways, but that means he's got to stay on his toes, which I don't think he minds as much as like all the fines and things he's had to pay, but because the government will be like, oh, now you're doing this thing, so now we're going to make this new tax for that thing that didn't exist before. But but yeah, he definitely got to stay on his toes, and there's a part of that that maybe he might like, as far as like, well, I did fish, and now like I want to sell whole trees with the gild attached, like there might be, that's fun, because then you're not doing the same thing year after year. But yeah, he might not like it too, who knows.
Well, my impression is that he embraces that's what it's going to be. that he knows that as soon as he starts selling yak, he's building a market, and then 20 other people in the area are going to start selling yak also.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they start doing that, then he switches to something else. But of course, you know, when they start raising yak, then of course they turn to him to get their breeding stock. You know, and so then he sells it to them for far too much money. I mean, for a while there, it was like if you wanted to raise ostriches, it's like they were like $20,000 a breeding pair. And then later the price dropped down to like $1,000 or something like that. So it has a lot to do with supply and demand. So I think that there's a lot of times when there is some sort of breed of animal that becomes a novelty and everybody wants it, and so then the price can be higher. So and I think he tries to cash in on that.
Yep.
So no, he's set, and then it's just basically creativity pays for him. But I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, and plus like you pointed out, it's fun. It's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, really, would he want to be supplying just the same thing all the time? I mean, I guess you'd want to balance that with really supplying the local necessities. Like, I think in our farm culture world right now, we've gotten away from just, you know, farms supplying the neighboring people with their basic foodstuffs. But beyond that, there's just all sorts of fun ways to tinker with, like, wow, what is actually available right now in this bioregion? And it could be a lot just more than just the basic food vegetables.
Okay. And then the last part I have marked off in that section is, it is important to remain flexible and not to invest money in rigid farming methods that will become unprofitable the second the market changes.
Mm-hmm.
My experiences and ideas, along with the old farming methods that I want to bring back, should encourage you to think and act independently again. The goal is to find alternative farming methods for your farm that are based on natural cycles and allow you to live in peace and harmony with nature.
Yeah. I think a part of that interested me, I'm not sure if he talks about it later too, but the thing about thinking independently is really interesting, because I think people show up for permaculture courses and training and, you know, want to get this set of techniques, but really emerge at the end by just having this ability to think creatively about all the different problems, quote-unquote, around them and think of them as solutions. So, of course, you would also apply that to your sense of being able to make money off the land and feed yourself, too.
Well, I think that you go in. I mean, a big part of taking a PDC or starting to study permaculture is going to be about trying to undo what you may already know. And it's like it is a very different way of thinking about things and a very different thing of looking at things. And so there's that. And the easiest way is to first start off with some simple recipes.
Right.
And then eventually evolve. Now, granted, it's like the difference between Fukuoka and permaculture. And you know, I think Holzer stuff is very similar to Fukuoka stuff, but Fukuoka was very emphatic. You know, that he felt that the difference between what he advocated and permaculture was that permaculture was like a big recipe book of things to do.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And he was teaching more of a philosophy of observe nature. And it does seem like a lot of Holzer's stuff is very, I mean, granted, we in permaculture, you know, observe is a big, big part of permaculture. But I think Holzer and Fukuoka take observe and put it on an even higher pedestal.
Yeah.
And so it's like for any given piece of property, what you're going to do there is going to be very, very different based on what you observe there.
Right.
And that's why I think most permaculture stuff is so vague already, is because it's kind of like each time you get to a piece of property, it's going to be what you're going to do there is different. And then even if somebody calls up on the phone and it's like, well, what do I do? What do I plant? It can still be really hard.
Well,
and
yeah.
Because the answer is it depends, and why the value of having somebody come to your property is a good idea.
Yeah.
Do you go to properties and do consultations?
I do. Yeah. I've got one next week coming up. I do the teaching thing more with more of my time, I guess. But I have, you know, a few year for sure. And then I'll do some installs or do, gosh, how does it work? What I, they'll pay, the client will pay me or a friend, me and a friend, to teach for a day. And then all these people come and take the class for free and install the garden as we're teaching about what, how the systems work. So, yeah.
I know. I get people asking me all the time to come out to their property and give them advice, and I always try to deflect to somebody else because I just kind of feel like when they are like, oh, I heard this neat word, permaculture, now I want somebody to come out and say permaculturally things to me while standing on my land. And I kind of feel like, yeah, you probably want somebody that's not me. And because I kind of feel like, you know, they're going to start talking about basically what they want is landscaping, but they want to hang stick a flag in it that says permaculture.
Right. And I'm okay with that. Like if someone, I mean, the kind of emails I get are someone's like, I want to totally take out my lawn, do edible landscaping. Like, what are the steps to get there? That's exciting for me. I like helping them with that process. And sometimes they're pretty knowledgeable in permaculture systems design. They just need someone else to come over and be like, yeah, give that a try. And a part of it is that, you know, there's that mysterious place where it's like, I don't live on that property and I haven't been observing it, but I can say, yes, within this valley or within this town, other people have had success doing an implementation like that or with this kind of fruit or something close. So there's definitely that always that gray area of like, you know, we don't know. It's hard for me to come in and say, I know exactly what needs to happen here, but I can get a sense of like the kind of food that they like to eat, how much time they can give to it per week, and help them with the process of just growing more food or medicine or fiber or whatever it is their goals are.
You are a far more patient person than I am. I'm generally okay with if they've like listened to all my podcasts or something, or you know they're already familiar with where I am and what I'm about, because it's like you know, you get these people that are like, oh, come over here and you know, stick the permaculture flag in whatever it is that I'm doing, and it's kind of like the experience has very little value for me. And then plus I take time away from doing other things, and I don't know. So I try to deflect them to other permaculture people in their area or something.
Oh
like
yeah,
that.
Definitely. I mean, if there's someone closer, but I know enough of your stuff to say like you really like to plant seeds for fruit trees, and it's like yes. The hesitation in my voice is, but if someone's just on an urban lot and they want to start growing food next year, like there's just a different, you're kind of extreme, Paul.
Yeah, exactly. And so then I'm only going to frustrate them, you know, and so that's why I kind of think, well, if I came in, I'm going to turn them off to permaculture. And so I, you know, that's why I deflect. I kind of like, hey, you know, here's some people that are in your area that might be a better fit for you. Yeah, because you're right. I'm going to say hoogle culture, and they're going to be like, oh, I don't know what my neighbors will think. And, well, fuck your neighbors. Just fuck them. Who cares? It's your property. You can do whatever the fuck you want. Well, I don't want my neighbors to be upset with me. You're going, you know, so then, you know, I don't know. I guess my position would be like, how can they be upset with you if you're giving them awesome tomatoes, you know? And, but yeah, no, these are real problems. And then I try to like, you know, okay, let's find a way to have the hoogle culture and be within your comfort zone. And it's kind of like, it just seems like one great big long list of sacrifice. And I immediately get this feeling like I'd rather be doing something else than what I'm doing at this moment.
Sure. And, you know, everybody's got different stuff. But I kind of see it as like you go to a piece of land and say there's like a weird slope and a strange water thing, and then a neighbor that's kind of indifferent and another neighbor that's kind of creepy. Or, you know, it's like you add all those into the set of problems that you're designing for. And I think that's fun, you know, to think of the social systems as like, how does this garden actually benefit the whole neighborhood? And for someone like you, you might be like, just fuck them. Like, they don't plant.
Well, I think a lot of people, when the thing is you go and you ask their permission, their answer is no. But if you go ahead and you create it, and then they see the awesomeness of it, then they say, this is awesome. And it's this kind of seems to be this recurring theme throughout all of my life. And I think, and this is, you know, I made a podcast not long ago talking about, you know, some of the big permaculture greats, why are they so cranky? And it's like, I think this is a big part of it. They go out and they do something awesome, but before they're done, they get this parade of people coming by saying, you know, cease and desist, you know, this is stupid, you're a dumb fuck, you know, whatever. They've got all this negative crap. And then when it's done and it exists, it's like, wow, that is really awesome. Why did it take you so long? You know, so I kind of feel like the part of it, is, you know. So I don't know. You're right. I want to blaze the trail, and I'm going. You know, better to ask forgiveness than permission. Build the Hugel culture bed 6 feet tall. People will get upset, and it's like, yeah, well, it's already built. You know, and it's my land. I get it. You know, this is I get to do this. But you know. So yes, better to have other people go in there who will be more polite, because I've just done too much of it to want to go and sit and have one more person say, yes, but I am a slave to landscaping ideals and it needs to look pretty and not have weeds.
Yeah, or I just walk around towns and I think, wow, a garden could go there, a garden could go there, a garden could go there. And, you know, if someone's calling me up to install a permaculture-based garden, then it's not going to be a toxic system. And, like, there'll be all sorts of differences, even if it's hugelkultur or not, you know, just to start seeing gardens everywhere.
Right. Or it's like they want to have these lush, sun-loving gardens underneath a bunch of pine trees. Yeah. Oh, these pine trees are just so large and beautiful. Well, how about if we limb them up a lot so more light can get in here? Oh, no, that would ruin the look. So it's like, okay, they want sun-loving plants to grow in the shade. It's good to want things, but it's like I don't really want to sit around and have an 8-day-long conversation with these people about this kind of
sure.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, and there's certain points where you can just be like, no, I see your idea, but it's not going to work with those plants. And, yeah, that's where mushrooms and ferns come in.
Other people are far more patient with that kind of thing than I am anymore. I'm tired of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we're trying to review this book.
Yeah.
But the key is, I didn't know that you did. I know you taught tons of stuff. And I know that you do a lot of work that's like very hands-on work in the world of permaculture. Like there's a project over there and you're in there working for 2 weeks to make it happen. And I know that you do a lot of that. And so then so it's good to know that you're also doing and now you're basically dominantly in the Tacoma, Puyallup area, Pierce County kind of thing.
Yeah.
I imagine you might sometimes pop up to the Seattle area or something.
Yeah, and actually I've got a permaculture course planned for Kamado Island, so that's north of Seattle. And that's a place called Shambhala Farm, and they've got a perennial vegetable nursery, and that's a permaculture course happening in June. So, yeah, just to take the opportunity just to plug that. It's going to be a fun course. They've already got a lot of different animals and cool internship program. They've been doing a CSA and have a perennial vegetable nursery, and so the owners of the land are trying to think about how can we use permaculture systems to make this, of course, easier for us and use less resources, but also to have more value added or products that come off the farm so that they can start to get more of their income based from that land rather than going off the farm to work.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So do you have like a web page or something?
Yeah, that's shambhalafarm.com.
You might have to spell that.
Shambhala Farm.
Okay. Dot com.
Yeah.
All right. So June.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving on to the next section, soil fertility. Oh, this first sentence, my reason for marking it is totally selfish and stupid. A healthy soil that is rich in microorganisms is a fertile soil. So of course, it's the words rich and soil.
Trying to figure out what was selfish about it.
Yeah.
Will your podcast listeners figure that out though?
Ha ha. that, well, of course, the podcast is at richsoil.com.
Oh, true. Okay, great.
That's true. Yeah. So, so that was all silly, not really important.
Okay.
The next part I have marked off is every plant has its own requirements and affects its surroundings and the soil in a different way. So this is the beginnings of polyculture, and he's going to get into polyculture more in a moment here. But I think that this is such a huge and important part, is that because a lot of times when we go out and we plant a garden, we try to homogenize the soil, make it all exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's contrary to the permaculture way, because every plant has different needs. Some people will go in and book up on exactly what each plant needs and then try to amend the soil for that plant in their garden. And then they'll go and they'll do these rows of crops or they'll do beds, and it's like, this bed's going to be all strawberries. And so here's how I futzed with the soil to get it to be more of a, you know, good for strawberries. But that's still limited to what we know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that soil stuff is far more complicated than we have yet to be able to understand. And so I think it's better to have lots of diversity in your soils. And so some globs are rich, and some globs are lame, and some globs are high pH, some globs are low pH, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these different variations. And then you plant your strawberries all over the place, and then some places the strawberries thrive, and some places they suck. And then they die, and then something else does well there.
Right, or even just letting the plant define its own soil by not messing with it too much, you know. I guess I have this philosophy that, you know, when the plants are doing well, just, you know, don't, you know, yeah, just don't try to mess with the ecologies that they're setting up or the companions that are self-seeding next to them, and just kind of stand back.
And the point he's making in this section is that the richer you make the soil, the richer everything will be. And rich has many types of rich. In fact, in the next section, he talks about green manure, but he starts right off talking about, I try to bring the nutrient content in over-fertilized areas back into balance using very demanding plants.
Hmm.
So, there are some things that will really suck up the nitrogen in the soil. And so if you do have heavy nitrogen soil, like, I don't know, it's possible that you ran animals in there for a while. Like, I think a popular thing to do is, like, if you've got good, rich soil all over your land, and then spring comes, and then the soil is really soggy and mushy, if you go and you run pigs and cattle over that mushy soil, it's going to compact it and destroy the soil.
Yeah.
And the soil becomes shallow. And so the thing to do is don't do that. But if you've got some land that's kind of rocky, then go ahead and run your animals out there, and then they'll deposit all sorts of stuff that will later make that spot much better soil. But that stuff that's left behind is so rich and hot that you want to plant things that are going to take that up and turn that into a more stable organic matter, as opposed to something that could potentially rinse down through the groundwater.
Yeah.
So... all right, so I'm popping along reading parts that I've marked. Am I?
That's fine.
Do you have spots in here that you've marked up?
I'm still trying to get over my thing of marking in the book. So no, but I figured you'd have things to say, and I just pop into that.
Oh, okay. See, yeah, I thought that for the first part, it's like basically the beginning of this chapter, he was talking a lot about social justice stuff. He started talking about the government and lobbyists, and he was talking about, you know, big ag and what they're doing and their relationship with the government. I thought for sure, that's like, man, that's Keldeville right there. She's
and maybe I'll throw in one more thing, is that we've got farm bill trainings in Seattle, and we've got another one planned for Maine, Tacoma, and I would just encourage anyone to get involved. I actually just need to go and learn myself, but how can we transfer this the idea that the government wants to help by doing farm subsidies to actually being beneficial programs and weaning big ag off of the big farm subsidies that aren't doing anyone any good. So, farm bill training. There's a group, Community Alliance for Global Justice in Seattle, that's been really active with that. So, there you go.
Well, I just kind of feel like, you know, these organizations that benefit the most from the subsidies are going to basically, I mean, I don't see them becoming unseated because they're making so much money from the subsidies. I mean, like Cargill, for example.
Yeah, and I think a big part of the Farm Bill training is to say, like, how can we be pressuring our senators and things so that they get the idea that this is not actually agriculture that's going to be sustainable. So maybe it won't be easy, but, like, that's, you know, might as well be informed to give it a try.
Okay. I think, if nothing else, it's good to at least start with the idea of saying, hey, when you do this stuff, can you at least not call it sustainable? You know, as opposed to, like, they go out and they say, hey, yeah, using Roundup Ready corn, that's sustainable. Can we at least stop saying that? You know, I that would be a nice place to start. So at least pretend that we're not that stupid. Something along those spaces. But, all right, next part I've got marked
up.
As I walk around the farm, I regularly check the condition of the soil in different places throughout autumn and winter. If I can dig up earth that has not frozen yet from beneath the snow, it is a sure sign of a job well done. So he talks about, you know, and this is the part where he's talking about he likes to leave stuff standing. He wants to see something where a green manure crop will grow so thick and lush and huge that by the time he starts going around to where other places it would have like a thin layer of something going on, and then you try to stick a shovel in it, and it's like, nope, that's frozen, man. Mm-hmm. Chunk, chunk, chunk. But then if it's something where he's done this thick, thick stuff, then he goes to stick a soil in it, and it's not frozen, then basically the soil is warmer. And then as all this organic matter, you know, gets knocked over by the snows and stuff like that, that soil will remain warmer through to the spring.
Well, and just to do the math for listeners who might not, I mean, basically we have soil microbiology that's still active. You have worms and all that stuff. Then you have like the food chain kind of systems going on. Then the soil will stay warmer and it won't freeze as much. But I mean, he's in an area. Well, it's interesting. Like, there might be certain reasons why soil should freeze. Like, it's, of course, a natural process. So I wouldn't say that, like, soil freezing would be bad if you're in that high alpine area. But he knows his land, and he knows it's still active. And so that's where that phrase comes in, that he's really proud when the soil biology is still active in the wintertime.
Right.
Because you could kill, I mean, maybe it kills off certain pathogens, or you don't have a certain bug problem because it freezes every winter, things like that. So it's not like the goal is trying to, you know, change nature away from that. It's just to make sure that there's a lot of health and vibrancy in the system.
True. I mean, it's only in areas where it does get cold, where it does freeze, where nature builds soil. You know, and you know, that's not entirely true, but there's a lot of truth to it, I suppose. The key is that it's in the warmer areas where you generally don't have much in the way of soil.
Oh, right, because you have to go fast. Yeah.
The microbes keep working all winter long, and like in the Puget Sound area, then what happens is that those microbes keep chomping away throughout the winter time, and yet stuff is pretty much dormant. And so you don't really have an active, you sort of have an active soil, and you sort of don't have an active soil. You don't exactly have an active plant life. So what happens is that your return is that your organic matter is depleted throughout the winter, and your plants aren't getting much, if anything, out of that. which is why I think that like an area like Missoula is better, because your plants will go dormant in Missoula also, but so will your soil. And it's easier to build soils. And then you get to the point where it's like, okay, it's summertime, and now the soil's far more active and there's a lot more organic matter. And we saved a lot of that organic matter from last year that would have dwindled away if we were in a warmer climate.
So I kind of think of it differently. I mean, I see plants growing right after the solstice, after the winter solstice. So there's little guys that are, of course, growing even in the winter. But I think what happens more here is that we just have so much rain that depletes the soil of nutrients rather than the growing cycles you just talked about.
I think that's true, too. Although, you know, the amount of rain that there is in the in Seattle is probably less than in Tacoma. Because you're starting to get down into an area where there's a lot more sogginess. But Seattle's 30 inches of rain a year.
Tacoma's like 42, I think.
Yeah, so a little bit more. Yep. And then there's areas like, how much do they get in the Ho Rainforest, which is not far from Seattle?
I don't know. I mean, I think it was
260 inches or something like that?
It's a lot. Yeah.
So, there's little patches. Some patches have more rain and it makes the soil very acidic, all that rain. But I really think that most of it has to do with it being warmer and the microbes. I mean, that's why when you go to a jungle or someplace that's very tropical, animal will take a dump and it'll be gone the next day because the microbes took it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's really no soil. There's like, you know, the dirt is generally like clay or sand or something in between, maybe silt, but organic matter is pretty much zero. All the organic matter is in the living plants. All right. Next chunk. Let's see. Thanks to their symbiotic relationship with bacteria, they grow well on dry and nitrogen-poor soil. What the hell are we talking about? Oh, we're talking about green manure crops. Some of the members of this family are peas, beans, clover, and lupins. However, legumes are not the only food... Legumes are not the only good green manure crops. A number of varieties of cabbage, oilseed rape, turnip, sunflower, and buckwheat are also excellent at improving the soil because they grow large amounts of leaves and fruit within a short period of time. So the only reason I marked that off is because I know a lot of people constantly want lists of species to play with. And so then there was a nice and quick list.
Yeah. And he's got a chart, too.
He has an awesome table at the end of this little chunk that we're processing right now of all kinds of stuff. And I've been reading through this, I've been making a list of questions that I want to ask him.
Right. That opportunity,
I think we need to kind of maybe get started on something like that. Like, okay, SEPs are common. And, what are going to be the questions to ask? I know that when I last saw him, I had like 3 pages of questions, and then it grew to like 9 pages as he talked. And there were a couple of points where he just stopped everything and wanted to work on just the questions on my list. So I think we once spent 3 hours, like the whole class stopped, and for 3 hours all he did was answer questions on my list.
Well, maybe he just gets tired of his own rants, and he's like, what do I do now? They're all looking at me. Paul!
Yeah, he would do that a lot too. But you know, I don't know. He and I really hit it off when he was over, but I want to ask him the really tough ones, because that's the other thing too. That was the part where I was getting kind of annoyed, was that. I think this time most people that have bought tickets, they bought tickets for the whole 11 days. So hopefully the stuff he talks about on the 11th day will be stuff that's different from days 1 through 10.
I think we talked about that in a podcast already, though. But he does tend to repetition sometimes.
Right. So, yeah. All right. Next piece.
Okay.
This is in a section he calls My Method. In autumn, I usually leave green manure crops standing. Nature does all the work for me. The first heavy snow pushes down the plants and they begin to decompose. In my opinion, this is the best and most successful way to improve the soil. So I answered a listener question not long ago where they were saying, what do you do in the wintertime? And I said, eat pie. You know, and I think this is pretty much what's going on here. I mean, basically, a good permaculture system totally takes care of itself. You don't do anything in the wintertime. Like the question was, do you put your gardens to bed, or how do you go about putting your gardens to bed? And my answer is don't. And I think that's kind of what he's saying here too. And in fact, I think of SEPS systems when I give that answer, because my impression is that everything takes care of itself. He does not need to maintain it in any way, and it's optimized when he does not have to maintain it anyway. Now, there might be some systems that are new that need a little bit of nurture to get them onto that path, but I think for the most part, nothing.
Yeah. Well, and it kind of goes into, like, how do I put my gardens to bed? And a lot of it is, like, I don't go through and, like, take out everything and put in cover crops. It kind of embarrasses me because there's a lot of good systems that work that way with, you know, with winter rye or fava beans or something. I do have areas like that that are, like, in the sheet mulched area in the front yard where I didn't have a garden growing this last summer. But for my other stuff, it's hard for me to think of, like, pulling everything out and putting something else in, especially here, because things can be productive so much later. And because I didn't pull things out, I still am harvesting salad greens that I'm selling at a local store right now. This is March, beginning of March when we're doing this podcast. But I think I also leave the infrastructure, and that's hard for people sometimes because it's like it looks messy, or it could just maybe things won't self-seed as much because they won't get as much heat or light. So there's like this balance of like how much stuff do you leave just sitting around the landscape, and how much do you pull out to make space for a cover crop for the wintertime or just the next planting in the spring. And so I think I'm still learning that. When I had my first garden, my very first garden all by myself, after I got permaculture training, I just left everything. And it was just hard to get the plants I wanted to grow because I also was hesitant just to take out, you know, quote unquote weeds. So there's definitely a part of like favoring the plants that you want as you leave all sorts of other interesting infrastructure for, you know, for the spiders to overwinter or all sorts of stuff. Right now I've got mulleins and plantain and things that are all protecting soil. Clovers, of course, lots of clovers. So, yeah.
Well, I think it comes back like Jeff Lawton stuff, and that is that if you get your permaculture system set up, you can walk away and leave it, and it will produce for you year
right.
after year.
Yeah, exactly.
And on the other hand, if you want to, you can go futz with it and probably double the food production.
Right. Sure.
And if you futz with it a whole lot, you might be able to quadruple your food production.
Or not, too. I mean, I think there's a sweet spot where you're like, wow, for the, you know, for that hour of work I did, you know, way months ago, I'm getting a lot of food. Whereas if I futzed with it too much, it might decrease. You know what I intuitively feel is like, the more I harvest, the more I get. And so that's the kind of work where you can do more of and usually get more from it. So.
True. So, I don't know. The key is especially when we're talking about something urban, because, you know, so many people, it's kind of like, I'm not a gardener. I don't have the skills. I don't care. I don't want to. And at the same time, it's like, okay, so if they had a permaculture system set up in their yard, that not only would it, you know, pretty much eliminate the need to mow, but there would be enough food there that at least it could save them a few trips to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And even if the food falls and rots, I don't know.
That's still benefiting the system, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're still moving forward as a society, as opposed to like, oh no, instead they have this great big plain lawn that they have to go and mow periodically, and if they don't mow it, they feel like they're a horrible person. And then there's the other variation, which is where they've dropped $15,000 for landscaping, which then requires $5,000 worth of maintenance every year. So
yeah, well, yeah, right. That's true. The more I interact with my garden, the more I get, and maybe it's just from the harvesting standpoint too. That there's more I can eat if I was just there more often. So yeah.
True. All right. Next chunk. Areas where green manure crops are cultivated have the advantage that the composition of the plants can have a significant effect on animals and insects. I often sow sunflowers and hemp because these plants are an excellent source of food for birds.
Hmm.
Okay, so I marked this off because, of course, it has the word hemp in it.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I don't know how many times we've locked threads out at Permies because it's like people want to start talking about hemp and, like, you know, well, all right, so clearly there could be some sort of government hassle, you know, but, like, what are the benefits? Is it worth it? And then sure enough, we get all kinds of discussion about people smoking dope or they're just excited about hemp, but they don't seem to give a shit about any other species.
Right.
And it's like their enthusiasm for hemp has to be because it's more like, let's get the hemp to grow for the shirts so that way I can grow the stuff that gets me stoned right next to it. And then the man isn't going to be able to tell one from the other.
Well, I tend to think of it this way. It's like the gateway gardening plant for a lot of people. I mean, maybe we know different people, of course, but a lot of people will start growing weed, you know, medicinally, we'll say, and then because they're getting into this plant, which is like they're really fascinated by, of course, all these different reasons, they start understanding how plants work and what plants want, and a lot of amazing gardeners get their start with that plant. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, so now I recently heard something about how for a lot of the things that we really like from hemp, that are like not the drug stuff.
Yeah.
That actually stinging nettle does better.
Oh, right, because it's a fiber. It's fast.
It's a superfood.
Yeah.
So there's this long list of stuff that you know is really great biomass kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd love to see nettle t-shirts. I mean, obviously that'd be possible.
So I just kind of think, like, whenever we have a hemp discussion, I kind of feel like anymore, like this is my new thing. Like, I just, like, about a week ago, I locked some thread where it was starting to get, you know, overrun by the kind of thing I don't want to see on Permies. But, you know, it's like, to keep a hemp discussion on track, I'd like to see a blow-by-blow comparison with stinging nettles. That would be valid. Because then we're looking at it from the perspective of farmers, polyculture, stuff like that. Although, you know, I still can't help but think that it's like trouble bait, you know, and so I can't help but think that in America right now, if you try to grow a polyculture and you throw hemp seeds out there, it's like if somebody wants to make you sad, they can just focus on that and fuck up your shit.
Yeah.
And so it's like, hey, those fucking hippies up on the hill, they're growing a bunch of pot. Let's send the feds in there to burn the property to the ground. You know? And so, I just kind of... So, anyway, but it's apparently in Austria, not that big of a deal. Or, Sepp's just got, you know, his balls are that big. But it, you know, so he's willing to blaze that path. Good on him. I don't know what the laws are. I am curious, but not so much that I would even ask him.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next chunk. Leaving green manure crops standing means I save myself more than just the work of cutting the plants down. This way, the plants can ripen, bloom, and produce seeds. I no longer have to reseed the area. Many seeds are eaten by the birds. Stratified in their stomachs, the layer which prevents germination is broken down. and are distributed in other areas. If I had to continually sow and plant my 45 hectares of land, this, in addition to all the other things I have to do, would take up far too much of my time. It would also be too expensive to have to constantly buy more seeds for sowing large areas of land. Wildflowers are incredibly expensive. So, this is green manure advice that runs contrary to 99% of the information out there on green manure stuff.
Yeah, and I like it because that's my method more than like thinking I'm going to take everything out and now seed the green manure. It's just like I'm just letting it all happen all the time. Yeah.
Right. Just leave it. It pops up when its time is right. And if there's other plants, you know, other production plants growing right there, it tends to sit back and wait until it's its time.
Yeah, sometimes you have to work it out between them. It's like, all right, you for a little while, and then you during the winter months, and, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, this is huge. This is huge. This is where permaculture is so different from regular gardening, and is so much less effort. So 45 hectares. So that's about 110 acres, if I remember correctly. On top of that, it's like, you know, one guy and 110 acres. Well, actually, it would be a couple. And I'm not even sure. My impression now, the latest, in fact, that would be a great question to ask him, is like, you know, do they really do anything on the original farm at all? Because I imagine it's all pretty much optimized. They probably spend all their time just going around and nudging things in this direction or that direction.
Although somewhere, I think he goes and redoes hugel cultures after a certain amount of time has gone by. I think I remember seeing that somewhere.
Right. But it's like something like 20 years.
Right.
But the other thing is I think that those were his old hugel culture beds that he started off that were much smaller. Like 12 years ago, the hugel culture beds, like he didn't build anything bigger than like 3 feet. But now he builds those giant hugel culture beds.
Mm-hmm.
And so they probably last much, much longer and are thus, you know, require maintenance less often. All right. On steep slopes and embankments, I make sure there's a large number of very deep-rooted plants like lupins and sweet clover in my seed mixtures. These plants do not only improve the soil, but they also stabilize the slope with their deep root systems, strong main and taproots. Their strong growth and well-established roots also improve the capacity of the soil to retain water. When you compare a slope of this kind with a meadow under similar conditions, the difference becomes even clearer. On the slope, the lupin and sweet clover roots are meters long, whereas in the meadow, there are mainly grasses with roots measuring only centimeters. In my polycultures, I have the soil and plants working to a depth of meters and not centimeters. On steep slopes and embankments, this effect is of greater importance because without it, heavy rainfall would easily lead to high surface runoff, the erosion of humus, and landslides. So, I was talking to Mark Vandermeer the other day, along with a soil scientist guy, and Mark was saying that a lot of the work that he's been doing lately has been to go out to where they've built logging roads, and his job is to put the hill back the way it was, to take the logging road out, because what they've discovered is that you know, because they kind of cut a little bit of the hillside out to make the road.
Yeah.
Well, you know, okay, yeah, they make a big cut in the side of the road, and the problem is that the uphill side gets saturated, and because of the way water is, with it's kind of got this certain kind of hydrophobia, where it gets to that cutaway. And then it stops and builds up there. Like it doesn't pass through the cutaway and then down onto the road.
Sure.
So the water, and I'm talking about the water that's kind of traveling downhill under the surface.
Okay.
And so once that bit of soil that from that cut into the hillside, once it gets saturated enough and the water doesn't go anywhere, then it does a little landslide. Whoosh. And one landslide can beget another landslide, and then by the time it's, you know, getting further down the hill, it's created a very large problem. And so so basically, Mark was saying your buddy Sepp, you know, is going to be having, you know, he advocates this stuff, and this is a problem. And so I spent probably an hour.
He advocates what stuff?
Making terraces.
Oh, right. Okay, got it.
Now, of course, he plants them all immediately with all kinds of stuff that's going to be stabilizing the soil. But, you know, basically Mark was kind of thinking that ain't enough. And so Mark and this other guy, who also has a lot of experience in this space, say that either he is a super genius that is aware of this problem and has techniques to mitigate it, which is possible, or all of the stuff that he's done to date, he's just been lucky. And because it is, I sat there and visited with him for an hour, and it sounds like, yeah, there's a lot of challenges. If you're going to get that to be stable, it's a lot of work. But, you know, I also think that Sepp does plant all those immediately. I mean, like, while the track hoe is still digging, you know, 100 feet away, he's planting it where the track hoe has just left.
Well, and it has to do with something I mentioned in an earlier podcast, too. It's just that the thought of slopes and maybe where is the ideal place to do agriculture, because, yes, we've had, you know, cultures around the world who've been terracing slopes for a long, long time, but it's not... It's a way of maintaining agriculture in a tough spot, but I would still say that the valleys and the river areas where the rivers just come through and deposit silt are a more ideal place to be growing food, as long as we have a flexible system that, you know, so you can live with the seasonal inundation. As far as like where should agriculture be, you'll probably disagree, but it's like I kind of feel like the steeper slopes, you know, the further away from towns, that's like that's zone 4 or zone 5. Do we really need to be growing annual vegetables in that kind of setup, you know? So
this reminds me of the last time I saw you. We went out to a piece of land where apparently you're going to be leading a bunch of permaculture folks as an educational exercise on what to do with this land. But I didn't know that at the time. And you asked me while we're approaching the land, what would you do with this piece of land?
Oh, I gotcha. All right. We went to a few places, so I know what you're talking about. Got it. Okay.
Okay, right. And so so as we're arriving, you're asking me what would, because I've been to this piece of land before, and my response was sell it. And then a big part of it is that it's in a flood zone.
Uh-huh.
And so now my mission for permaculture is different than for a lot of other people. And so my feeling is like, okay, I get the soil to be awesome, I start adding texture to the land, I do all of what I believe to be totally awesome, and then along comes a flood and takes all my awesome and gives it to everybody else, and then I get all the shit soil from all the places around there that are big Monsanto fans, and I get their crap dropped off on my place. So once a year I get this reset, and I don't get reset to the beginning of natural land. I get a reset that includes toxic gick.
Right. I mean, the toxic gick is part of that. We need to eliminate that from the system. But I think there's still something to be said for, like, how, you know, if a town is growing tons of potatoes, like, yes, you can do that in polyculture, but, like, should they be trying to figure out how to, well, maybe potatoes is, but, yes, you could do it in the hills, but there's also, like, these river valleys, which are really fertile. And I mean, the Nile, like people had agriculture there in a sustainable way for so, so long, just because you get used to the system of the river as it wants to be. And And I don't want to say that I don't like gardening in the hills, because that's where you get your slopes as far as like doing all sorts of interesting things. But I kind of have this intuitive sense that it should get, you know, more and more perennial and into native woodlands the steeper you get into your slopes.
So I think that, you know, granted, really steep land is going to be really difficult.
Right.
The other thing about valleys is that that's your frost pocket.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where all your cold air pools.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I want to be at least 20, 30 feet above that.
Right. Well, and that's kind of like when you talk about siding a house on a hill, like there's that mid zone where it's like not high yeah. enough that it's going to be windy all the time and not low enough that it's going to be in the frost pocket. And
so there, yes, you've just said my very point. Now you've located your house in that perfect place, and now a moment ago you were saying, shouldn't that be zone 4? But now that your house is there...
No, because the part of it that's different, too, is I'm thinking of, like, towns and how, like, where are we placing towns and settlements in relationship to the whole landscape? And so this is, like, you know, obviously I would love the conversation about, you know, where they're, you know, like, yes, there's that sweet spot in between the ridge and the valley, but there's a part that I'm hesitant to say, like, yeah, get a land with a slope and then build hugel cultures when maybe the sloped land should just be left forested. I mean, it's like above the key point, especially. We have this land use pattern of just putting houses or farms and things in all these places where we're not really acknowledging the systems of that the earth wants to be in. So, just to throw that there.
I see, you know, so the next thing is like I had a friend of mine come to me and say, oh, look at this, isn't this sad? They want to take this 100 acres of farmland and they want to break it up into these 5-acre plots and build homes on it. And so that's so sad to see that land go from agriculture to being just somebody's house with horses. And it's kind of like, well, you know, there's a much richer picture there. Of course, if we're going to go from like some sort of Monsanto-based agriculture to something where each one of these households is either permaculture or has the potential to do permaculture, this is better. You know,
yeah, that's kind of like the Anastasia thing too, where I'm like, no, because I'm all about villages, and so it's like isn't like if you have 5 acres spread out to the end of the horizon. That's a lot of infrastructure for travel. Like clustered villages make a lot more sense, and the more that people want to steward land, then the closer to the outskirt of the village that they live. But I'm not going to agree with you about taking a big chunk of land, having 5-acre little ranchettes.
No, I mean it depends.
Okay.
But, I mean, who's living in these houses? Are they going to do, I mean, but you're right. They're probably not going to do permaculture. They're probably going to do something.
And I hear what you're saying as far as like, why would it be bad to have more stewards living on the land, which is probably how you see it, is like rather than this farmland that's like one guy and a big tractor goes over, like why not have people that have a relationship on a smaller scale? So.
Right. So when people are standing up and saying, oh, no, it's horrible, we're losing all of our farmland, I kind of think to myself, like, I'm having a hard time working up a tier when we have less, you know, Monsanto-esque land. And it's kind of like, because I very much like the idea that rather than having 1,000 farms that are 1 million acres apiece, I would much rather see 100 million farms that are 10 acres apiece. And I'm not sure if my math adds up to be the same for either one of those. But it's like the Cuban oil, peak oil thing, that movie that they had where rather than having their farm truck or the food trucked in from 100 miles away or 200 miles away, what about the idea of stopping by on your way between work and home, stopping by and getting food that's grown in a little garden there? And they've got like a 1-acre plot or a 2-acre plot in town.
Right.
And then there's a lot of very intensive horticultural practices going on the outskirts of town.
Right.
And so now the longest anything travels is probably 5 miles.
Yeah. Well, and the thing I want to see is, you know, big acres of farmland like this property you're talking about that your friend was going to say was split into 5 acres. Is I want to see places like that be able to turn back into like zone 4 areas or more forested wild areas, because we're able to grow so much more food closer to our homes. And so that's kind of the trajectory I see it going. Do you see the other way? Do you see where I'm getting at?
I think so. I guess the thing I want to advocate is super local, because
yeah.
I think that there's a lot of advantage to the farmer's market, but it's still petroleum-based, and it's still a heavy petroleum thing.
Can I brag for a second?
What?
Oh, I need to brag for a second. Is that all right?
Go for it. Brag away.
So a few weeks ago, this is February, you know, wintertime around here, I started selling garden produce, surplus garden produce from my garden to a shop on Main Street, which is about a mile from where I live. And so it's a small town, and there's nowhere to buy local produce in town until that. There's another farm that like does kind of like a buying club thing, but it's not their food this time of year. So anyway, I started selling salad greens and kale and chard and things like that. It's just like a walking distance to my house in February. So it's, as long as you're talking about super local, it's been really interesting to see how to do all the permits and things to do that. Like I had to buy insurance and, you know, try to make it all legal. but it's happening. So.
Well, I would like to think that there's a couple of huge things that can go on with that food. One is that, I mean, first of all, you can call it Kelda food.
Yeah.
And then part of it could be totally petroleum free. Not only was this stuff grown without any petroleum fertilizers and whatnot, but on top of that, it was brought to this store without any petroleum.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so then the petroleum free. And then the next thing is that if you're growing it in a polyculture, like let's say you're growing it and each lettuce plant, like the roots of that lettuce plant touch the roots of 20 other species, I want you to label that as polyculture 20.
Right.
I'd like to see this become like a terminology that becomes universal.
Yeah. Well, I'm more of like a polyculture 3 or 4, which I think, I mean, to get production out of it, I'm harvesting the leaves individually, and so it already takes me like obscene amounts of time to actually do like a salad harvest. So I don't know if I want to up the polyculture to 20, but I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay, but because then, okay, so first of all, I'm thinking that being petroleum free, there can be a premium on that.
Right.
And so you can sell it for a higher price. But then the next thing is that if you got polyculture 20, you can sell it for an even higher price. And yes, it will then take longer to harvest,
mm-hmm.
but
right.
you're getting paid for
right.
it. Then, because I think one of the biggest things there is that when you talk about food as medicine, I believe that when you have food that's polyculture 20, I believe that is 20 times greater medicine than non-polyculture food, than monocrop food, which is what most of the stuff on the shelves is. So when somebody has got, like, let's say, cancer, and they're trying to beat it without going under the knife, your food is of far greater value. Like, your kale that comes from a polyculture 20 environment is going to be of far greater nutritional value than something grown in a monocrop.
Yeah. Well, and already, I mean, the salad, you can just kind of feel it, because it's like you can't buy a salad like that anywhere. Anyone who's done polyculture systems and made salad, it's just like there's so many different things that are in there. And so you can kind of get that sense of like the high energetics of it to get a little woo-woo. But it's like, you know, I'm kind of like pushing this plant aside to get to that leaf and moving this plant to get to that other leaf. And it's like there's such, I don't know. I just want to call it high energy. There's such abundance where the system is – is happy for me to take stuff out of there just to give room to like more plants to grow. And it's just so diverse, and coming from a situation that hasn't been watered. I mean, of course we get rain around here, but also all those roots are mingling together. Yeah, totally. And right now I'm selling it for like $10 a pound, and I kind of roll my eyes because I don't make my money. You know, like I'm spending so many hours harvesting it, but I don't want to charge $20 a pound in this town. I want people just to eat it and
feel the superpowers,
yeah,
and become awesome, and
exactly,
and then have a parade for Kelda, and yeah, I get it.
One day, maybe $20.
Okay, next section. A mixture of sweet clover, lucerne, vetch, peas, lupins, sunflowers, and different tubers like Jerusalem artichokes and turnips are well suited to this. And
what?
This would...
Oh, sorry. It's just kind of out of context.
It is out of context. So it's tied into the part that I just read, but it's a whole new paragraph, and so it's, you know, it's about what you're going to plant to be a good seed mix as well as for slopes. So yeah, to keep away the landslides. I was recently talking to somebody about, you know, trying to introduce polycultures into what they're doing, and it was a couple. And they were very keen on hearing from me, but then I mentioned Jerusalem artichokes, and her response was, yeah, I'm never planting that. I'm not planting any artichokes on this land. And that's when I kind of thought, and this conversation is...
Right, it's her loss.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, I just kind of don't want to go down that road. You know, I think that people who listen to my podcast, and people who watch my videos, and people who participate in the forums at Permies and read my articles, stuff like that. I mean, these are people that are going to be like, Jerusalem artichokes, sunchokes, you bet those are the best. And it's like, maybe you don't eat them, but they're great chicken feed, they're great pig feed, and they're a great survival food. And most people, the people that don't eat them, I think that they just haven't found a good recipe for cooking them yet.
And on that,
you know.
On that note, last Saturday I got this phone call from the place where I'm selling food, and she was like, we're out of sunchokes. Can you harvest some more? And I actually couldn't because I wasn't in town, but it was really funny just to, because that same day I was working with a small crew, and we just unearthed all these sunchokes that were just coming up where they shouldn't be. And so it's just funny to think that they sold out at the grocery store too. So that's, you know.
So and these people, the person that says, "Oh, I'm never growing anything called Jerusalem artichokes. I'm not sure which, like maybe the word Jerusalem was the bad word or artichoke was the bad word, but the thing is, they're not going to grow it. And it's like, but at the same time, they're talking about possibly, you know, bringing in pigs. And I'm kind of thinking, wow, you know, if I'm thinking there's one thing I'm going to plant for pig food,
right? Oh,
it's sunchokes.
Yeah.
What would be better?
Yeah. Well, they do like the
nut trees would be better, but you got to wait 40 years to get the nut.
The turnips, they're called something different when they're pig food. Those are awesome too. Mango?
Yeah, the mango beets.
Yeah.
So there's
okay,
that. I was thinking like certain kinds of radishes would be good too, like the daikon radishes and stuff. But I think sunchokes, I mean perennial, they're going to be the king right there, I would think. But I thought it was funny that, you know, to get the negative response. All right. Mistakes. He's got a section in here called Mistakes.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think is kick-ass. The widespread use of flail mowers, which are very common in Burgenland and Steiermark, stands in opposition to the principle behind environmentally friendly green manure crops. And the main reason I wanted to mention this is because this is the primary technique that Helen Attow used. I don't think she used flail mowers, but she did use mowers. She mowed. And so that was, she wanted to stress the clover, stress the legume crops, the green mulches, the living mulches, to give off more nitrogen.
Right, and I don't use it. I mean, it's just walking and pulling at it when it's getting too big, stomping. So there's other ways to stress out your clover.
Right, and I do kind of think that bringing in big equipment of any kind is generally not a great permaculture path. I do think that you know, equipment can have its place, but and I like the idea of having a farm that does have something.
Or if you've got a really big place, you could just have toddlers just run up and down in certain areas. Because sometimes with a big, it's like, yeah, the walking and stomping won't work for just the farmer, but like, you know, have a path, you know, that leads somewhere, or have some kind of fun shape, and then you can encourage people just to, what you're trying to get is more people to interact with the plants so that you don't have to bring in the machinery.
How about goats or cattle or pigs,
right,
or chickens? I mean, because, yeah, they'll come in and they'll eat a lot of that stuff. And then that'll lead to a certain amount of die-off, which then fertilizes everything around it. But, yeah, you could maintain a herd of toddlers. Yes, that's true. have a little daycare going or something. And okay, kids!
That's so symbiotic, you know? Cause, I mean, a lot of it, I feel like the parts of my garden that suffer are just the ones that are furthest away from my house, you know, just because they obviously zone one gets hit more. So if you just have more interaction, and, you know, the right ways.
Well, true. Although I think that opens up a whole other can of worms too, because those kids are hard to herd, and then you know, talk about taking on a lot of your time to manage. Jeez. anyway, that is an interesting strategy, Kelda. All right, hey, that's
get it.
That part, I'm kind of like cruising through here, looking at like what this is. Chapter 2 is huge. Alternative agriculture. It gets into chapter 3 is fruit trees. So we've got, oh wow, we've got a long ways to go to get through chapter 2. But all right, that's it for this section. Anything else?
Nope, that's good.
All right. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about the mighty, the glorious, the amazing Sepp Holzer, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.